often surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile.
Let the bass kick. This is something to... This is something to... This is something to... This is something to... This is
Welcome to Space Lab Extra, the Base Agenda spin-off show that digs deeply into the history and prehistory of Electro. I'm your host, Billy Proctor, and joining us today is Simon Reynolds, author of many seminal books on various genres of popular music, including, and I'll take a breath, Rip It Up and Start Again, post-punk 1978 to 1984, Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century, Energy Flash, A Journey Through Rave Culture and Dance Music, Bring the Noise, 20 Years of Hip Hop and Hip Rock, and the forthcoming Futuromania, Electronic Dreams, Desire Machines and Tomorrow's Music Today, which is due to be published by White Rabbit on April the 11th. Well, thinking about all these books and writings over the past 20 years or so, one thing strikes me is how eclectic your musical interests and tastes are. Although I'd argue that all popular music exists in a kind of matrix, each genre actively in conversation with other genres, what is it specifically that drives you to engage with such a wide span of genre, of history and culture?
I don't know. I mean, see, I think what you just said, that the things I got into were connected to other things. That, you know, the very first group, I got into the Sex Pistols and then Ian Dury and the Blockheads, who were probably the best. Well, this is debatable because there are other contenders, but, you know, I would say one of the best funk bands in Britain at that time, even though they were sort of marketed as new wave. But, you know, they were plugged into funk and blues and disco. Chaz Jankel, the June Smith, wrote this great song, I Know Corrida, that Quincy Jones covered. So that just led me sort of organically, you know, initially I was attracted by the swearing on the Ian Dury's records and the, you know, the scabrous lyrics. But, you know, the funk in it sort of pulled me into, you know, liking Michael Jackson and records and all kinds of other funk records. And then, you know, then people in post-punk music were listening to reggae and funk and early rap and that sort of, you know, you just get pulled into one thing connects to the next. You know, they are all in conversation. I wrote this book about post-punk, and you know, the sort of shadow story of post-punk is this amazing period of black music that they're inspired by. Disco, funk, electro, early rap, African music as well, you know, it's just that sort of the nourishment that they all drew on. So it's just having ears, really, I suppose. I mean, I do get bored easily, but so I'm constantly checking stuff out. But you know, you couldn't not be excited by, you know, when you, like, I heard about the first import single I bought was the Wheels of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. You know, I actually went, you know, it was a totally unknown thing for me to go up to London and buy an import. It was like twice the price of a normal 12-inch single, and like, but it was, you know, had to have it because I'd read about it, and it was like, you know, it's made out of other records. That sounds really wild, you know. So I just was curious to hear all these other things. I had a friend who was a DJ as well, the writer David Stubbs. We were students together, and he was a DJ, so he was buying imports and introducing me to a lot of club music.
So you're kind of just like pinballing between all these different things because of what interests you. You're not writing about stuff that doesn't interest you, are you?
Not often. I mean, I can do. I mean, sometimes, you know, like sometimes it's the story that is interesting, you know, like I feel like I could write, you know, I'm not insanely interested in heavy metal, but it's such a wild and wacky subculture that I probably could write a a good piece just observing the subculture. But, you know, I tend to luckily have been able to write about what musically excites me, and luckily I've got quite wide taste. I mean, there's some things I just I'm not into, like modern country music, say, but yeah, you know, I was looking to be surprised, you know, so that's sort of what led me to all these different things.
Do you still get surprised?
Not as often. I think so. I think the trouble with getting older is that your ears sort of you've heard so many things that you kind of can place things, you know what I mean? So that, yeah, you know, you sort of can hear the precedent. But, you know, still, every so often, something will surprise me. It may not even be sonically, it might be the lyric content or the, I know, emotions in music. What it says about where people's, you know, where young people's heads are at today. You know, I might find some resonance on that level. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there's so much music history that even though I've been listening to this for decades, there's still so much music history that I've not explored properly that I get surprised by things from the past, you know.
Mm. Yeah, I think if all music stopped being made today, we'd be fine. We'd be fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I've been listening to Miles Davis 70s music for ages, and I still feel like I've not got to the bottom of it, you know. Although someone like King Sunny Ade, you know, loved quite a lot of his music, but he put out about 40 albums at least. So, you know, there's just, you know, even artists that I know quite well, I feel like some of them, there's still more to learn about them and discover. And
let's talk about Future Mania. So electronic music, in my research, always seems to have been associated with the future in some way, whether expressed in utopian or dystopian terms, I guess.
Mm.
And although electronic music has many musical ancestors that span at least the 20th century, it's the 1970s, I think, that witnessed the rise of the machines, as it were.
Mm.
And thinking about the 1970s, they were a very pessimistic, cynical period for many reasons. Politically, ideologically, all of that. So in cinema, for example, you've got films like Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, or horror movies like The Exorcist, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the very bleak refractions of the wider cultural and political environment. Yet by the second half of the decade, there seems to have been a shift towards more utopian expressions. George Lucas's Star Wars perhaps spearheading a new frontier in science fiction. A shift that I think is also captured in the music being produced during the period and from then on. What did the future look like in the 1970s, Simon?
Well, actually, I think this connection between synths and the future or outer space was actually made a little bit earlier, which was like a lot of the avant-garde electronic composers. They happened to be doing what they were doing around the time of Sputnik, the first, you know, satellite in space, and then the beginnings of the race to get to the moon. So actually a lot of them named, you know, that sort of the two things, synthesizers and space, outer space travel, and this sort of futuristic technology were kind of sort of linked. Because actually, you know, if you look at the NASA Control Center with all its bleeping lights, everything actually looks a lot like the early, very bulky synthesizers that you only got really in institutions like universities in America or state radio stations in Germany and France. So, and then you saw a lot of composers like Stockhausen with a lot of the his titles he came up for pieces were like cosmic kind of imagery. But yeah, and I think generally speaking, in terms of popular culture, you're right, the 70s is when that sort of widest connection of electronic music and science fiction happened. I actually think of it sort of somewhat differently. I think like initially you have this sort of view in films of space or the future as this kind of clean place, like, you know, film like Logan's Run, it's all very clean. Actually, it looks like it's filmed in a shopping mall. It's all plastic and man-made fabrics and everything. And then you have quite a bit of electronic music on the soundtrack for that. I think it's Jerry Goldsmith. There's a fantastic piece he does called The Love Shot, which is like a sort of futuristic sex disco orgy space. Love Shot. And they kind of have to escape through that. And you can see all these couples having sex in the background. And this sort of... So there's this sort of pornotopian electronic music thing that I think you also got in the film Barbarella. And then you got it in like disco with I Feel Love, and you know, although it wasn't electronic, Love to Love You Baby was kind of like disco erotica, wasn't it? But even I Feel Love kind of has that thing of you know, it's a super intense love song, but she's singing in this kind of weirdly disembodied way, and there's this incredible juggernaut of electronic pulsations that Moroder built, and Moroder and his crew, I should say, there's, you know, a whole team of fantastic technicians and musicians built this futuristic, mechanistic, yet sort of erotic disco track. You know, just everyone, you know, everyone says, I heard it, you know, it's like Eno heard it and rushed over to David Bowie and said, this is the future. You know, the Human League were kind of almost formed around that record and Kraftwerk. I remember being startled by it as I was 14 or something, and it's like, you know, it was like number one for a week in the UK, I think, and it just sounded so like nothing else. And that was actually, you know, Moroder's plan was to make a song for the future. You know, he wanted to make a song that the only human element was the voice. So that's this, yeah, it's this sort of clean, utopian, sexy future. Then you start to get films like Alien, where the future's kind of grotty, you know, it's like, they're kind of peons, there's this corporate, you know, they're out there, the corporation has sent them out there, the spaceship is all dark, it's like they can't afford any, you know, they can't afford more than a 40 watt light bulb in there, it's dripping with condensation, it's really like grotty future. And then you have films like Blade Runner and all these sort of films where future's a bit shit, and or John Carpenter's Escape from New York, which has the great, he makes this great electronic soundtrack to it, and but it's like a, you know, a decayed, collapsed, crime infested, well, it's New York's been turned into a giant prison, hasn't it? It's like where all the worst criminals in America are penned in. So I feel like, you know, yeah, the future starts to look a bit shit, and it's no longer that sort of super clean, sterile future that you tended to have depicted.
There's a book I read recently, I can't remember the author's name, even though he's a brilliant writer, and it was about the KLF. But he wrote a book after that, which was talking about utopia, and he's saying, like, in today's world, we've lost the ability to think of utopia. So a Disney film that came out a few years ago with George Clooney called Tomorrowland was a big utopian film that just didn't do anything at the box office. And his argument was, we're so used to dystopias now, and we're all very cynical because the world's a bit shit.
But if you look at all the, you know, the young adult fiction, a lot of it is sort of on the lines of The Hunger Games, which I think was originally a young adult fiction, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Suzanne Collins. Yeah.
It's all like, it's, you know, kids seem to love reading about these scenarios where everything's terrible and there's this tyrannical state or tyrannical corporations, but then they imagine themselves as the, you know, the adventuresome rebels against it, you know. That seems to be a scenario that people enjoy. You could say it's sort of displaced anxieties about what's going on in this world now. I actually did read an optimistic book about the future. I mean, it was set during climate crisis, but it sort of shows these people trying to sort of come up with solutions. It's called The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. It's a great book. It's so it does come, you know, there's a lot of things that go wrong in it, climate disasters and stuff, but you're sort of left with this feeling that there are people in this world who are probably working on solutions, and maybe humanity will just about pull through.
So there's, at least there's a discourse of hope there.
Yeah, but apparently there is a whole genre, I haven't read much of it, called cli-fi, like climate fiction. Climate crisis fiction, you know, which is another take on that, I guess, a take on a catastrophe novel, which I used to love reading growing up. All these books, J.G. Ballard, about, you know, ocean levels rising and London becoming a tropical city as the world heats up, which seems more and more plausible, doesn't it?
Unfortunately, it does, yeah. Well, you've mentioned Marauder, who I wanted to speak about next anyway, and you begin with Marauder in the new book. And I think in the history of electronic music, Marauder doesn't seem to receive as much credit as, say, Kraftwerk. And I'm thinking that maybe that's because of Marauder's association with that dirty word, disco.
It might just because, you know, Kraftwerk are like such a total package. They have the great image and the... and their ideas and concepts, whereas Marauder's work on the face of it doesn't seem to have that. Actually, you know, his partner, Pete Bellotti, did a lot of the Donna Summer records. There was a concept for them, like they, you know, they were themed, and it was often inspired by literature. And I Feel Love came off of a record that was meant to be, I can't remember the book it was inspired by, but it's like something like Anthony Powell's Dances to the Music of Time, maybe. It was like idea that, which is like a 12 volume sequence that goes through many decades of someone's life. I've not read it. I think the idea was they would do a record that was like, it was called I Remember Yesterday, and each song would be set in a different era of pop. And then almost as an afterthought, they thought, let's have a song for the future. And it's going to be the last song on the record, and no big deal. And what to them, you know, they asked themselves, what does the future pop sound like? Because they've done like a Motown style record, a girl group style record, a funk record, you know, a 1940s swing band kind of song on this album. What would the future sound? Well, obviously synths. I mean, you know, it had to be all electronic. So they made this all electronic track. And then they thought nothing of it. It wasn't going to be the single, but the guy, Neil Bogart, the guy at Casablanca Records, their label, had a very good ear for what was the single. And he said, you've got to make this one a single. And if you extend, you know, it was only 3.5 minutes long. If you extend it here and here, and make it 5 minutes long, it's going to be huge. And, you know, the rest is history. It was number one in the UK, a month, I think. It was number one in many other countries around the world. It was number six in America. It's like this anthem. Loads of new wave bands were influenced by it, you know. A lot of gay disco, high energy music kind of comes from that track. Techno and trance people love it. But I think you're right, there is something, you know, Marauder's never quite been cool. It might be the moustache. might be just these themes so of that disco era. He did also make some, you know, very mainstream rock kind of sounding records later on. And,
in all of the interviews that I've done with electro musicians, I Feel Love comes up more than Kraftwerk, would you believe?
Oh, it does? Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
And I was speaking to Cosmo D from Nucleus last week or the week before, and he spoke about when they were playing it in a park in Brooklyn, and the response from the crowd was, what the fuck is this? Mm. Kind of like one of those moments. I think I read it in an article you wrote for Pitchfork when you're saying it's kind of like there's these, I mean, I would consider Planet Rock in a similar sense, you know, that type of thing where it's like it's a game-changing tune. Something's in the wind. And another thing that gets mentioned quite a lot is From Here to Eternity, Marauder's solo album from, I think, the same year.
I mean, they put out so many records. It wasn't just Donna Summer that the Marauder camp did. They did this great album with Sparks. He had several Giorgio Moroder solo albums, and then he did all those soundtracks, some of which are very electronic and excellent. Like the soundtrack to Midnight Express has The Chase on it, which is a great sort of burbling electro disco kind of track. He did a whole bunch of music with Donna Summer. Not all of it was electronic, you know, he actually did less and less as they went along, but they did this fantastic one side of the double album, Once Upon a Time, is this sort of three track song suite that's totally electronic. Now I Need You, Working the Midnight Shift, Queen for a Day, and it's sort of the peak, I think, really, of the Marauder summer synergy, really. It's incredible. You know, it's very much sort of, it's like an evocation of the glittering neon metropolis kind of thing. I always, in my mind, I pair it with Neon Lights by Kraftwerk. It's sort of, as you say, the utopian idea, the idea of city of light, you know, the all the possibility and excitement of the city, the bright lights, big city sort of scenario.
Yeah.
Although Working the Midnight Shift is actually about being lonely. You know, it's about someone who has a night shift. And so while her friends are out going to discos, she's like, you know, trying to stay awake, doing her job, and she goes home to sleep just as everyone else is coming home from the disco.
They've all gone out dancing. They're all
I mean, it often comes across as hyperbole for people who weren't around when that record hit the dance floor in the pop charts. So I always play it to my students. So these are people who are ordinarily between 18 and 21. They're mostly familiar with it, and they shrug their shoulders when I try to explain that there was nothing like it at the time. But of course, they've grown up in a technicolor, technological, techno world, if you like. So they don't have a frame of reference for it.
That's the problem I have. I'm teaching as well, so I'm continually trying to historicize things and say, look, there just wasn't anything like this before. And I know you can make this track on your phone now, but the labor that went into making something like I Feel Love, or you know, and the fact that they were doing it and no one had really done anything like it before, you have to sort of try and create that excitement in the context of things, but it's difficult. You know, we live in a world where electronic music is commonplace and easy. You know, you can get like that kind of 16 note pulse very easily.
I mean, at the time, the MIDI hadn't even been invented, so you know, they have to get these things at the same speed and all of that. You know, it was totally different.
The Human League, one of the things that's amazing is they didn't have a drum machine early on. They had to make the drum sounds out of little bursts of white noise and pink noise and stuff, and sort of clip them to get a sort of hi-hat-like sound, a snare-like sound. And in fact, that's what Moroder and Bellotti, because they wanted to have a completely electronic drum sound. But the one thing, one concession they made was they couldn't get the Moog to make a thick and heavy enough kick drum. So they actually got this great drummer, Keith Forsey, to just play the kick drum, you know. So he had to just play, you know, he had a very sort of good sense of time. He was like a sort of metronomic drummer. And so that's like the one little, along with the voice, that's the one human element in I Feel Love. I think, you know, I mean, I quite like the sort of the search for precursors and these sort of things that are ahead of their time. But you do have to try and also be faithful to the fact that there are these records that seem to sort of be game changers and how people reacted at the time. And the reaction to I Feel Love was totally, you know, gobsmacked for a lot of people. It really did have that effect. You know, the story of the Human League and like Martin Ware going around to Phil Oakey's house, hold it, spoke, you know, sometimes you wonder if these stories are mythified a little bit. You know, supposedly holding Kraftwerk, Man Machine in one hand and I Feel Love in the other, and saying, this is what we should do, this is our direction. Before that, the Human League were called The Future, that was their name, and they were kind of making like Tangerine Dream stuff to kind of music. Like they had a track that was 79 minutes long, you know, and much more like spacey. And then they were like, oh, actually we can be a pop group, you know, and be futuristic. Well, just yesterday, because I was thinking about, we were chatting, I was sort of looking up some stuff, and I came across this quote from Afro Bambaataa. He says, Gary Numan, man, he was dope, so important to us. When we heard that single, Our Friends Electric, it was like the aliens had landed in the Bronx. More than Kraftwerk, Numan was the inspiration. He's a hero. Without him, there'd be no electro. So I thought, well, that's amazing. I had never heard that before. But one of the things I think about Numan is quite interesting. He had a real drummer, didn't he? I think, at least for several of the early albums. A guy called Cedric Sharp, who actually lived in my hometown, in case you see him crossing the street. And he had been in a prog rock band. He's a really good drummer. And I think, although it is very synthy, they were quite relatively rock, and even on some early records, Gary Numan is playing a mean electric guitar, with sort of clean riffs. But I think that's one of the reasons it cuts across so well, is that, you know, it's futuristic, but it's kind of rocks, and it's got these great riffs in it, and the drumming was great. Yeah, I think maybe later on he went to totally drum machine. I'm not sure. Do you know if he did that?
I think the first couple of albums was live drums, as you say, especially with Tube Army for sure. Pleasure Principles, live drums and live bass, I think.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's a proper band. It's band music, and there was a lot of stuff that was at that time that was kind of interestingly transitional, like Simple Minds did stuff that had a kind of Moroder influence, but you know, they were like Empires and Dance, that album, I Travel, you know, it has this Moroder pulse going through it. Killing Joke did some stuff that had kind of clear Moroder influence. So there's a lot of the sort of new wave post-punk groups were very much, you know, listening to that, thinking, this is our ticket to the future kind of thing, that sound. And then there's a Fantastic Sparks record.
OIM, is it number one in heaven?
Yeah. And Beat the Clock.
Yeah, they're really, really good album. That's a really good album. The one album I haven't yet been able to track down is one of the ones you mentioned in a piece, an early Marauder album. I think it's called Isenganger.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you can find it on YouTube, but if you just want to hear it. But yeah, I'd love to get a vinyl copy, but I think they go for quite a lot. That's interesting, because it's sort of, you know, he seems like Mr. You know, one of the, I suppose, his secret of his success, he was quite a hitman in the sense of, you know, he had a sense of the commercial and he was always looking to sell records, but that's a complete oddity. It's like, you know, actually he makes a quite experimental, weird, goofy little record there that, you know, can't really have imagined that was ever going to be a hit. And it does show that, you know, he had this experimental side that maybe he could have taken a leap further.
Down in the park where the Mike men made.
So in the UK, the history of dance music culture tends to exclude electro in favour of what Greg Wilson has termed the Ibiza myth.
Mm.
And one of Greg's examples that he wrote about and he told me comes from Dorian Lynskey's book, 33 Revolutions Per Minute from 2010. And it's just one example of, I mean, Greg's read it loads of places I have. And the quote that he uses on his website is, the DJs who brought house and techno to Britain did so via the sun-kissed idyll of Ibiza. And, you know, from Greg's perspective, and maybe mine as well, what makes this myth more sinister, although I'm sure it's unconscious, is that house music and you know, indeed electro, kicked off in the north of England, primarily in black spaces. So the way that the history is documented is a kind of whitewashing in some way. I'm sure it's not purposeful. But in the way that the history is being documented, it's as if there was nothing between the demise of the Northern Soul scene and the emergence of rave culture in 1988. Why do you think that is? I mean, Greg calls it the missing link. And I didn't know that when I started to research this, but clearly with Greg, I've interviewed Greg a number of times, and he's really changed the story a lot. Hip-hop comes into this country through electro, not through rap. It's Malcolm McLaren's Buffalo Girls. And then, there's a guy called James McNally, who's an academic, who argues that it was video that did it. So the video for Buffalo Girls, I'm sure you've seen it with the scratching and the b-boying and all of that. And Greg Wilson says he was in a club and he asked everyone just to watch this video because that had a screen. And he says, and that's how he knew what the term future shock meant. He says, because the night was over. Everyone watched the breakdancing and all, listen, just went. And it was like one of those I feel love moments, you know. But I remember last year I emailed you and you shared with me a little, a liner note of sorts that you'd written for something that hadn't been published. And it was something that you were saying, before rave, before techno and all of that, there was the street sounds generation. So obviously you're aware of it, and everyone who knew about that music is. There's another book I read recently, it's called Party Lines by Ed Gillett. And he's kind of arguing similar things. He's saying the prehistory of rave and techno is in black spaces in different parts of the England, but he didn't mention electro at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously something kicks off in 87, 88 that is like a whole subculture emerges with clothes, a new drug, and then this, you know, extreme sound of acid house. There's no point denying that there's a unique convergence of energies that happens in London, but it also happens in Manchester and then Sheffield and abandoned factories in Lancashire and stuff. I mean, it's more or less simultaneous. So it makes sense that it's the starting point if you want to talk about rave culture and the clothes and behaviours and slang and the whole package. It does, you know, does start there. But there's, as with all kinds of music, there's a prehistory. At the time, I remember it, you know, as someone who bought some of the records and had a friend who was a DJ, ran a club, and I even did a bit of DJ, you know, very amateur DJing myself. To me, it all felt like kind of amorphous mush of stuff that happened at the same time. So, like, for instance, I don't see a difference really between electro and rap, because, you know, you think of Planet Rock, it's got rapping on it. There were electro tracks that didn't have rapping on, but, you know, they felt like the same culture. Records that had scratching and like something like Electric Boogie by West Street Mob. You know, it's got a breakbeat in it, but also scratching. It has the vocoded voice, you know. But then that even electro and rap sort of seemed to blend into, there was, well, the, you know, at the time we didn't really know the term freestyle, but what people call freestyle, like the Shannon records, you had all this sort of electro-funk stuff, post-disco stuff, Atomic Dog, you know, by George Clinton. It was all this sort of futuristic synth and drum machine employing music. And it kind of evolved, you know, like it evolved incrementally. Like you had 1 minute disco and funk were actually band-based music, so you had like an actual band playing. And then synth bass comes in and drum machines start displacing. Even the records that Jam and Lewis were making, the early ones, like SOS Band, you know, where it's soul, but they have like, they're using a Linn drum. It felt like a spectrum of future forward, danceable black music. And then you had, you know, white artists cottoning on pretty quick. You mentioned McLaren. I think of the Art of Noise records as being part of this moment, you know, and one of the greatest, you know, Man Parrish, very interesting figure. I only quite recently realized he was a white guy and had this history with glam rock and all this kind of stuff. He made a great track, just maybe the greatest electro track, I don't know. Who are the people who did Dominatrix Sleeps Tonight? One of them was this guy, Stuart Argabright, who was in a group on Factory called IKEA, sort of a post-punk, sinister funk thing. And then I think another guy was Ken Lockie, who'd been in a new wave group. So, you know, you had a lot of new wave post-punk people, including New Order, obviously, copying on very quickly to this sound and contributing, you know, and New Order going down to Jelly Bean Beneath this club, the Funhouse, and testing their track Confusion that they made with Arthur Baker. And so it all felt like a mush, really, of a spectrum of this electronic dance music. Range of stuff that had, you know, had songs and was, you know, love songs, essentially, to stuff that was just pure, like, futurist instrumental stuff, you know, the break dancing. It seemed to sort of come about at more or less the same time over a span of a few years. And I think that is the prehistory of rave in a lot of ways. That's what a lot of people who were key figures in, you know, the bleep scene in the north of England, early jungle, if you look into their personal history, most of them were B-boys, you know, like LFO, Mark Bell and Des Varley. They met when they were rival teams in a breakdancing contest, you know, getting the lino out, doing the spinning and all that in some shopping arcade in Leeds or somewhere like that, and became friends. And then a few years later, they start making these great, essentially British techno records.
Yeah, I spoke with Mark Archer from Alternate a while ago, and he said it was electro where he started. Billy Bunter, the rave DJ, it was electro. And there's a book by Joe Muggs, which is an oral history of sound system culture, and a lot of people in there talk about electro being their kind of Damascene conversion. So it's I agree. Like, everyone who was into electro when I was young went to the rave scene, including myself. But for me, the funny thing is, I never listened to rave music when I was sitting at home. I was always in a club. I was always in that context. I was also always with a magic pill.
Dominatrix.
Days, I do think electro was a part of hip-hop. I think what's happened is, this actually came from Man Parrish, she said, the term hip-hop has been hijacked by rap. And what he meant by that is, the term hip-hop now just means rap music. Whereas back in the day, it was the four elements, it was breakdancing, graffiti, and all of that. So what's happened in the history of hip-hop, I mean, the so-called 50th anniversary of hip-hop last year, electro's nowhere, it's not mentioned at all. And so it's not part of that history. And it's not part of dance music history as well. Even when Planet Rock's mentioned, it's normally Planet Rock, Hip Hop, Bebop, John's On Crew maybe. No one talks about what was going on the West Coast. And what's amazing about that is that's where Dr. Dre gets his start, with the World Class Wrecking Crew. And, you know,
most of the sort of, you know, people talk about the Dirty South, that old version of hip hop in the 90s. That's all rooted in electro, whether it's Miami bass, New Orleans bounce. Now I lose track of all the different variants, all these sort of cities that have this sort of southern, you know, it's all booming 808 and music that's primarily to shake your butt to. And it has rapping on it, you know, people rapping about butts or about, you know, gangstery kind of stuff. But, you know, the primary point of the music in the sort of southern hip hop tradition is to dance to, you know, it never loses that element. Whereas I think what happens is that hip hop in the 90s increasingly becomes a kind of headphone music, and like you get these incredible productions, like a cinematic and the poetic lyrics, the whole thing of the lyricism, and maybe people chill to it, maybe people dance to it a bit, but it's not like the real shake that ass kind of music that sort of seems to flourish in these regional city-based scenes, you know. And there are some not just in the south, like there's this sound called hi-fi in San Francisco that's very much like booty music, and it's all traceable back to electro. So it's funny what you're saying about, well, it's sad in a way that electro is being written out of it, because it's right there in a lot of this stuff that came through, like, I don't know, Cash Money Records from New Orleans in the early 2000s has all these links to electro. Most of the sort of Dirty South's wave of rap, it was so exciting.
I mean, even on NWA's, Straight Outta Compton, there's a track on there called Something to Dance To, and it's electro. Wasn't on that album, wasn't on the vinyl, it was only on CD, because at that time they were trying to push people towards a new format.
And funnily enough, you will still hear, you know, right into the 21st century, every so often you'll hear a track that has, like, you know, it'll sample a bit of Kraftwerk, or it'll have the Malcolm McLaren shouting into the echo chamber bit at the start of Buffalo Gals. You know, it's sort of like almost the samples become resampled and become like these sort of folk memory. So and people hear it probably don't have no idea, you know, young people have no idea where it comes from originally, but they know it sort of somehow harkens back to the early days.
There's a lot of freestyle tracks that I hear even now that are basically singing over an instrumental of Planet Rock. I think you did mention a track where you thought that electro was mutating into house, and that was Let's Get Brutal by Nightboard Deluxe.
Yeah, that's somewhere between. He was a very interesting character. I blank on his name, but he came from Philadelphia, and he had one point had been in Sun Ra's orchestra. Avant-garde jazz background, but then he started making these weird, spacey sort of electro, but sort of tinging towards house, but still essentially electro records. Let's Get Brutal. But another one, you know, New York, you know, is sort of famous for a garage and this soulful kind of house music, but there's a whole other side to it, which is Todd Terry and people like that, where it's quite a lot of hip hop and electro in the mix. Todd Terry did this track with this group Royal House called Party People, and one of the mixes is called B-Boy National Anthem, and it starts with a sample from Planet Rock. In fact, the title phrase, Party People, is from Planet Rock. And it has a sample from an early song by Tila Rock, It's Yours, which I think might have been produced by Mantronic, I'm not sure. So in New York, there's these things that are somewhere in between, like Mantronics are sort of, what are they? They have a bit of rap, but they're also really electro, but he's very influenced by The Art of Noise, but he's, you know, later on there's things that are kind of more poppy house, you know. It's like Todd Terry has this sort of, you know, using lots of samples, rough and ready kind of house sound that is very influential in the UK. So when you start looking into it, the borders between these genres start to crumble a bit, and there are all these things that are sort of, as you said, a lot of them, if you trace it back, electro is right there at the start of the journey.
What else can readers expect from Future Romania?
It's a theme. I'd like to call it like a themed collection. It's you know, it runs through a lot of the history of electronic pop and dance music. Not everything, you know, you can't cover everything, but you know, I have Moroder, I have Ryushi Sakamoto and Yellow Magic Orchestra, I have synth pop and industrial music and acid house and quite a bit on jungle and rave. So really right through to the auto-tune era of rap, which was something I found very exciting the last few years of the 2010s, sort of 2016 onwards. You had a lot of people really pushing auto-tune and other vocal processing effects, coming up with sort of very unusual ethereal sounds, to the point where some rappers weren't really even, it wasn't really about lyrics anymore, it's about the weird kind of textures and effects they were able to generate using that technology. Very quirky, very, you know, someone like Young Thug, Future, who I love, partly because he's called Future, you know. Migos, you know, all these Playboi Carti is one of the ones who's, you know, does these very strange vocal effects. The baby voice, the Playboi Carti baby voice, they call it. Yeah, it covers a lot of ground, and it's sort of really sort of running themes and leitmotifs to do with the fantasies and dreams that people, you know, utopian or dystopian visions that the music tends to evoke. Futuristic music, but also it comes with science fiction themes and you know, ideas of what tomorrow will be like. So I look at all that. And there's stuff on the history of science fiction movie soundtracks, and also a long essay about science fiction novelists and how they've tried to imagine what the music of the future would be. So it's sort of, I think, you know, although it pulls a lot of different things, there's kind of threads that run through it that I sort of tie together in the end in this sort of conclusion. One thing I sort of, as an angle, I'm kind of very interested in the human side of it, and the fact that it's always people with stories who are doing it. It's not like the machines are making the music themselves. Machines are made by humans. And, you know, you have often quite oddball characters who come up with something distinct and personal using this technology. And they're pursuing their own obsessions. And so I sort of have a bit more, compared to some of my other writing, I have a more emphasis on these strange individuals, you know, and the visions they're chasing.
Yeah, well, I look forward to reading the book, Simon. That's Future Romania, Electronic Dreams, Desire and Machines and Tomorrow's Music Today, published by White Rabbit on April the 11th. If listeners have enjoyed today's episode, check it out. And that's it from me. Look out for more episodes of Space Lab Extra in the future. We play out with one of the tracks Simon mentions. This is I Travel by Simple Minds from their 1982 album Celebration. Until next time, remember, electro is oral sex.